Hello, everyone, and welcome to Psych in the City. I'm your host, Sarah Kelleher. Hope you learned something. I'm really excited about this conversation. I'm speaking with a friend of mine about something that I know little to nothing about. Shayna was born and raised in the Chabad Hasidic Orthodox Jewish world of Brooklyn, New York. And today we're going to talk about her experience as a member of the community, about her journey with Hasidicism, and she teaches me all about this sect of Hasidic Judaism. She shares her experiences with sex education, her work as a couples therapist, and ultimately her journey with self and belief.
Okay, cool. Okay, so today I'm speaking with my friend Shayna. Hi, Shayna.
Hi.
We had met because your fiance and my boyfriend were childhood friends.
Yes.
And we were introduced. We've become, I think, you know, getting to know each other more and more. And you have, you know, I've never met somebody that has your background, and, you know, we were both social workers, which we connected on. So today we're going to be talking about a lot of that. And I don't even know really where to start. So maybe introduce yourself a little bit.
Yeah. So I'm Shayna. I'm 29 years old, and I was born and raised in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, which is predominantly Chabad Hasidic. And Black.
What is Chabad Hasidic? Want to clarify a little bit for us, because I'm excited for this episode because I think I'm gonna have a lot of what I was taught about what being Hasidic is, and then versus an actual experience with somebody that grew up Hasidic.
Yeah, so Chabad Hasidic, it was founded by Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, who's known as the Alter Rebbe, Rebbe as in rabbi. He is the older rabbi. And it's a type of Judaism and a type of Hasidicism that is founded on Kabbalah and the deep mysticism, the deeper parts to the Torah. Some of the teachings come from Rabbi Isaac Luria, who was a great Kabbalist from many, many years ago. And the teaching about it, Chabad stands for, if you translate it into Hebrew, stands for knowledge, stands for wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. I hope I said that right. And that's sort of what it's based on. It talks a lot about the soul, the different parts of the soul. Also talks a lot about combining physicality with spirituality and sort of making them one. And another sort of goal of Chabad Hasidicism, which is how I was born and raised, is the Rebbe, the current Rebbe who passed away. He had a bunch of followers in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. He passed away, I believe, in 92, right after I was born. Or maybe it was 93. And he wanted to create a place where Jews would have a place to go all over the entire world. That is called shilichut, going out into the world and making a Chabad house, a shul, a synagogue. So no matter where you go, if you're a Jew and you go to Timbuktu or India, you are going to have a place where there will be a minyan, you know, a congregation. Where you can go and do that. So that was sort of a big goal in high school. We talked a lot about that, about kind of, you know, are you going to like live in Crown Heights, or are you going to go out on Shilichut, you know, and build a Chabad house in, you know, the far out, you know, world, or here in New York? I mean, they're everywhere. And yeah, it's kind of how it was.
Yeah. So is Chabad, and you ended up stepping away from that community, or tell me a little bit about that. I mean, I because we've talked surfacely about it, but not you know, what was your experience? Like, did you, I mean, you grew up in it. So it sounds like you, did you know anything else at that time?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the myths, I guess, of it is, you know, people see, you know, Hasidicism, at least Chabad Hasidus, as, you know, very insular and very much a bubble, and I don't know about anything else, but that wasn't my experience. You know, I can't speak for my friends, you know, what they experienced, but my parents were not born and raised Orthodox, and so we were the only ones in our family that were religious. So I was exposed to my cousins and family from a young age, grandparents, and, you know, kind of, but this is like how we practice and what we believe, but I wouldn't say it was, you know, an extreme thing. Yes, you know, it was more of a bubble. You know, I kind of believe that every community is a bubble. Mm. You know, Briarcliff is a bubble. It's the suburbs, you know, white suburbs.
Right.
You know, San Francisco is its own bubble where I live now.
And yeah, so your parents, they, as adults, they started to become Chabad Hasidic.
Yeah, as adults, they found Rabbi Greenberg, who was the Chabad Shliach in Buffalo, New York. And they found, you know, the Chabad house over there in Buffalo. That's kind of how they found it. That was a goal of the Rebbe, that, you know, Jews should become closer to God and Judaism, spirituality. And so that's how my parents kind of found it.
So the perception, I guess, is when I think of any type of Hasidic person. I mean, I live in Williamsburg now, so we have a separate, are they considered Hasidic?
They definitely are. Those are generally Satmar Hasidim, or Bells, or, you know, Ger, who come from different parts of Eastern Europe. And they are generally, again, I'm not them. I didn't grow up like that.
Right.
Generally more insular, no internet in the home. We grew up with internet. And years later, we always had the slow dial up.
And yeah, I mean, well, first off, I guess I think there's a misconception, and I'll speak for myself, or like that, like there's only one type of Hasidism, you know, like it's just, if you're Hasidic, that's, there's one way to be. And then I guess is that it's very conservative, extremely conservative. Yeah. I just, did you find that? Like, am I completely off with all of that?
Did I find what?
Are those misconceptions, or the misconceptions that you've heard, are they completely off? Is that not your experience at all?
Yeah, some of them are off. For example, secular education. For me, I was raised Chabad and I had a secular education. Mm. And, you know, was it the best? No, but when you compare, let's say in my neighborhood of Crown Heights, you know, the Regents, New York State Regents, the public schools in that area to our school was way ahead. And, you know, so who's to say, but then again, but when I went on to college, I did very well. It was fine. Mm. Again, the boys have it different. The boys tend to stop learning, secular studies after about 9 years old. So a lot of them, you know, are behind in math, reading, all those skills.
Why is it different for the women?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly, but I believe that people would ask the Rebbe. Often people will come to Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson and ask him questions about things. And I feel that he believed that boys should be completely immersed in Judaic studies. Mm. And after 9 years old, it's closer to the bar mitzvah age of 13, and they shouldn't be involved with that. Today, that has changed a lot. The Rebbe is no longer alive. And there are many boys schools in Crown Heights that do have English studies. Mm. Yeah. So, but in Williamsburg, right, if we're going to talk about that, they do, to my knowledge, do not have secular studies for the boys, definitely like nothing. And then for the girls, I think it's very minimal.
Education at all, right?
No, the girls will have a Judaic education, but English, the secular studies, I don't believe there is so much of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you grew up with internet, you grew up with like, and you know, it was just, you had a very, religion was a huge part of your family and culture.
Yeah, definitely. We had, you know, kept Shabbat, kept all the holidays, kept a kosher home. We dressed modestly, which meant that I only wore skirts growing up. The first time I ever put on pants, I was maybe 25 years old or something.
Wow. And like long skirts, like skirts to the floor.
Yes, we followed the laws according to the Torah or according to the rabbis. Covered our elbows, neckline.
Why elbows?
Elbows are considered, what I was taught, you know, elbows are something spiritual or just can, you know, some people, I saw that, you know, I see it differently than other people. There is one opinion that's like elbows are sexy and that could turn on a man, and so you shouldn't do it. Mm. Another opinion is, you know, this is your body. You should cover it up and be modest and, you know, reserve it for the sake, you know, sacred marriage and relationship for time with your husband.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So was that, I mean, I guess I'm interested too. And you come from, you have seven siblings?
I have six sisters and two brothers.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so are men and women treated and socialized very differently? Similar, I mean, similar to just in general, even in non-religion cultures, but like, were they treated, were you socialized very differently?
Yeah. So men and women are completely separated. I went to an all-girls school from, you know, kindergarten through high school. And we didn't have, you know, prom or anything, or, you know, I never, my first date, I was 21. No, I think I was 19. And that was set up by a matchmaker when I was, you know, preparing for marriage. Mm. And yeah, no sort of, you know, communication with that. When you go to shul, the synagogue, we sit separately, the men and the women. At weddings, we sit, eat, dance separately. And you know, I could look back and say, oh, that was so terrible. You know, I wish that I, had more exposure to boys, but in a way I kind of feel that being at an all girls school, there is a certain power in the high school, you know, especially when it's all female.
Mm.
I consider myself to be a very strong, confident, independent woman. And I wonder if that would have been different if I had boys in my class, might have been more shy, you know,
yeah.
Just as my experience, you know, somebody else, you know, that's their experience.
When we met, which was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe, but you had started to kind of go on your own a little bit from my understanding, and maybe step out a little bit, or am I incorrect with that?
Yeah. So when I saw your question in the email, it said, you know, when did you leave or how did you leave? And I was laughing a little bit inside because I don't know if I've ever left.
Mm.
I feel very strongly tied as a Jew, you know, very, very much a very strong, proud, happy Jew. You know, want to raise my kids to know that they're Jews. You know, I feel that, you know, Jews are a small minority and we've survived a lot. And, you know, I'm proud of that. And in terms of the religious, you know, Hasidic lifestyle, I think that, you know, it's sort of a natural progression, kind of just discovering myself away from it. But there are still parts of it that I'm tied to. You know, I like the music. I like love Hasidic music. You know, I still keep Shabbat to a certain extent. I don't use my phone because I want to break from, you know, technology and social media and all that. But in terms of keeping, you know, the day to day, you know, do I dress modestly? No, you know, that doesn't really talk to me anymore the way it used to. And my siblings, most of them are very tied, you know, to being a Jew. And the culture, but kind of all sort of went away from that lifestyle. I still pray at times. But in terms of keeping it, it doesn't really work for me. And I don't think that, you know, religion is for everybody.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed now actually looking at those questions, because many of them are framed as how did you leave? Was it hard, etc.? And frankly, that's my bias and conception of Hasidicism, and really, I guess, a little bit of all organized religion, in the sense that stepping away leads to being ostracized in some form. And I've learned, in quotation marks, about Hasidicism from the media, such as the show Unorthodox and other documentaries, because that's really the only access I've had. And I've had no access to discussing and meeting people from that community. Yes, I live near a Hasidic community and observe people in my neighborhood and where I live. And it does appear to be very different from any community I've seen before. And again, that's, I'm seeing some aspects of it from very far away. And I knew and grew up with Jewish people and had some Jewish friends, but they practiced and embodied their faith similarly to me, in that it was something you did because that's what you were and your parents signed you up for it, and it was very much in the background rather than the forefront. So yeah, I mean, my conception of what sects of Hasidicism is or can be are very much based off of media depictions.
Yeah, totally makes sense. I'm a little distracted. I was laughing because when you said, you know, I know a lot of Jews, Andrew always says, Mark is an honorary Jew. He's an honorary Jew. He's completely Jewish.
Well, no, I mean, the town that I grew up in was, my mom is a teacher in the town over. And growing up, she always had off all of the Jewish holidays. And then my school never did, because for some reason, it was just like, we didn't have a lot of Jewish kids. And then her school really did. And so, but when I met you, it's like the first time I met you, we were at Shabbat and that kind of stuff. That was never, I never had done anything like that before. And so it's just, I feel like that's why I have this conception of like it being very intense, when really I have no idea what it's about at all. But I think from society, that's what I'm taught to view it as, you know. But it's funny because now I'm looking at the question, it's like, when did you leave? Was it intense? Was it bad? Like, but I mean, because I thought that's how it was, you know, like I thought it was looked down upon if you had decided to. But aren't all of your siblings fairly, everyone has kind of done their own thing a little bit and created their own, like.
Yeah, definitely. For my family, you know, it's unique in a way. I had a lot of support. Yeah. And it wasn't like, oh, I decided, you know, I left or I don't believe in this anymore. There are probably two things in the entire, that I know of, you know, in the entire Torah that I don't believe in, which I think a lot of other religions have this. One is their stance on homosexuality, LGBTQ+, you know, that bothers me. I don't stand for that. And the other is the Jewish divorce laws. So a Jewish divorce is called a get. And it essentially, you know, and it's a big problem today, where if a Jewish man refuses to sign the divorce papers, a woman is held and chained and she cannot remarry. According to Jewish law.
If he doesn't want to sign, you're not getting a divorce.
Yeah, you're not getting a divorce, and it will often be used against the woman. And there is way to make change even using Jewish law. And, you know, rabbis are hesitant, but, you know, change is happening, but slowly. And it's just, I know too many women that are chained down, and that's, to me, is just horrible, and I don't agree with it. But in terms of everything else, it's not like an ideology for me of, oh, I don't believe in God, or I don't, you know, want to keep this. It's sort of just, it's not working for me. I'm not going to do it. And I didn't also grow up in a bubble, so it's kind of like, you know, easier for me. I went to college. A lot of other people, let's say coming from such as the movie Unorthodox, you know, she had it much harder. She grew up in, I believe it was Williamsburg, and, you know, her experience was vastly different from mine and my family. I can't speak for other people that live in Crown Heights because they, you know, may have had it harder. You know, for example, I have a friend and she grew up like 12 siblings living in like a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment, you know, and her parents were very, very extreme, like Chabad. You know, and we talked about it now recently, and she's like, yeah, it was like vastly different. She's like, you know, your mom was like, oh, like, you know, go to music lessons and like, you know, or do these things, you know, get swimming lessons. that is somewhat, you know, kind of outside that box. And so, yeah, the girl in Unorthodox, her name is Deborah Feldman. And yeah, she had a very different experience. And for her, it really was like, you know, yeah, of when did you leave, you know, and how did it happen? And she was married. And I believe she had a child, I think. Yeah, so just, you know, very different. And she did, though, have the support of her mom, who was also had left the community, but she had to find her in Berlin. Yeah.
Is what your parents did, is that typical? Like, they kind of found, how did they, because they didn't grow up Hasidic.
Yeah, so it is actually in Crown Heights and in Chabad in general, because of the Rebbe's mission to create a place where a Jew could go anywhere in the world and have a Chabad house. They had access to it. And so they were taught by the rabbi. So there is a whole bunch of, it's called Ba'alei Teshuvah, who are returning to the path, sort of. They've returned to the path of Judaism. And so that's how they found it. And yeah, my parents, there's a bunch of families in Crown Heights who are similar, did not grow up Orthodox and became, yeah.
Do you consider yourself, or did you grow up Orthodox?
Yeah, I was raised as an Orthodox Jew. And now what I consider myself, you know, I don't want to put myself in any box. But, you know, I just say I'm Jewish. In the first, you know, probably 60 seconds of meeting me, people will know two things about me. One, that I'm a Jew, and two, that I have 8 siblings. yeah. So
when you, you know, decided to maybe, I mean, I guess if this is the terminology, less Orthodox, what drove that decision? You said it wasn't resonating for you anymore, but like, what aspects? Like, was it some of the things that, like, you mentioned the divorce thing, which you didn't like, and the stance on LGBTQ community, and what made you be like, this isn't working for me anymore?
Yeah, so it was kind of like a slow process. I think that modesty, the laws of modesty, were very hard for me. You know, I wanted to wear pants, wanted to just, I'm a swimmer, wanted to swim with men and wear a bathing suit, you know, wanted to ride my bike and wear pants and shorts. You know, I don't want to be restricted, let's say kosher. I still keep kosher, but I not according to the way my parents raised me to. You know, I'll eat at a non-kosher restaurant, but I don't eat pork or, you know, shellfish or anything. I'm vegetarian. I tell people vegetarian, kosher, picky.
Was that, and that was kind of, you know, little bits here and there that you had kind of decided to change, just little aspects that became.
Yeah. And then sort of, you know, moving to San Francisco was a big transition for me. I moved here last August. My partner is a doctor doing his residency at UCSF. And so that's why we moved out here. And, you know, there isn't, they say there's a lot of closeted Jews here. But, you know, with the pandemic, it's been hard to begin with. I'm not a synagogue person. I don't think that I'll ever belong anywhere. I just don't, it's not like how I connect to my Judaism, is by like joining, you know, a temple. For a lot of people, that is what it is. And yeah, so it kind of shifted there, you know, in terms of like my relationship. I don't, you know, it's, Andrew's very open to it, but it isn't something, you know, that I necessarily, I just sort of shifted, you know, we've shifted together. And it's kind of, I can't really say it was much different than when I was living in New York, because it's kind of also like, you know, tried not to drive on Shabbat, you know, didn't use my phone, same thing, kosher was same thing. But there's less pressure here. You know, when I lived in Brooklyn, before I moved here, you know, I had to watch what I was wearing, because I'm afraid my mom will like bump into me and she'll just lose her shit. Why are you wearing pants? You know, that aspect has been challenging. The disappointment, I guess. My mom is disappointed.
What about your dad?
No, my father is like the most just chilled out, doesn't care, just do whatever you want, you know. He's just like a hippie, wants to play music all day, but is running this business. And he's just, you know, wants to, he doesn't really care. He's just like, you know, I love you.
I was going to say, is there some pressure when, like, from family or extended family or people in, like, that you grew up with, maybe that when maybe you wore pants or whatever the thing was, it was kind of like a big deal, or no?
No, the only pressure or the only guilt I have is from my mom. And me and my mom sort of have a complicated relationship. Complicated, difficult, you know, painful at times. So yeah, for her, you know, it was a big change. You know, she's seen a couple of pictures of me here and there, and you know, that's been problematic.
So you keep it separate?
I keep it separate. I don't tell her, you know, I don't want to hurt her unintentionally at the same time. Like, this is my life and the life I've chosen. And I, you know, I understand her. I think it's hard. I'm not a parent, but I think it's hard as a parent. You know, it's when your child chooses something different, you know, whether it's religion or going to college or, you know, a profession or lifestyle, whatever it is. You know, so I have compassion for her, but it's been a challenge. So it's kind of nice to live in San Francisco, you know, away from that. But from the community, no, there hasn't. People, you know, have been accepting. It hasn't really been like
people get, you know, it
up for discussion or anything. Or I think it's so common. There are so many people that have you know, left the community. That's why there's my Unorthodox Life out.
Oh yeah, have you been watching it?
Yeah, I saw it. I thought it was just the Jewish version of the Kardashians.
I haven't seen it yet, but I want to watch it. But yeah, I mean, So it's fairly common.
Yeah, I would say so today. Yeah.
I mean, do you, this is kind of a strange question, but do you resent any of it? Like, do you, cause even again, like I grew up, I guess, Catholic. I mean, I grew up Catholic, let's say, and there's a lot of some of the ideology, you know, as a woman, it's misogynistic and it's dated and it doesn't, you know, it kind of paints men a little bit higher and all that kind of stuff and traditional gender roles and all that kind of stuff. And even though it never resonated with me, I think I internalized maybe pretend, or I think people can internalize some of those, the messaging that they're given, like purity culture and like all that, you know, the modesty and the emphasis on modesty and not, you know, have to protect ourselves from men and all that kind of stuff. And do you feel like that happened for you at all?
No, I don't have resentment. I think that, you know, this is how I was raised and it made me who I am. And it, you know, I love myself. And, you know, it gave me extra knowledge. Like I know how to speak Hebrew, read Hebrew, speak Yiddish, read Yiddish. Kind of made me who I am. And I'm grateful for that. And I also think, like, you know, as I said, the first 60 seconds of you meeting me, you know that I'm one of nine and that I'm Jewish. And I don't think I would have all my siblings if I grew up, you know, not religious, because traditionally, you know, in Orthodox Jewish families, the, you know, birth control is sort of a no-no. Of course, you could ask a rabbi and get permission and everything. So I wouldn't have, you know, my eight siblings that I have and that I'm so, you know, and all my nieces and nephews that I'm just madly in love with.
Tell me about some of the sex education or lack thereof. I mean, so you said birth control, you know, you come from a big family. Big families are pretty common.
Yeah.
And tell me, like, about conversations about, like, sex and, like, how a citizen views sex and all, and, like, sexuality and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, sex is something that is reserved for marriage. Marriage usually happens. No one's going to force you to go out on a date in Chabad Hasidicism. But there will be a shadchan, which is a matchmaker, who will, you know, when you're of age, which is usually, like, 20, you will, you know, go for a meeting with her and she will, you know, ask you a bunch of questions and then try to set you up with a guy.
Who is so, the matchmaker? Like, how do you get that job?
Yeah. So there are, there are multiple matchmakers in the community. And I believe, you know, it is their job and they have a right and they charge for it, you know, that kind of meeting. And then I think if the marriage does happen, that there's an engagement, it's whatever fee. I think the person that my mom went to, I believe, was like $1,200 or something.
Set you up with someone.
If we had gotten engaged.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Got it.
So there's that person. And she kind of, you know, looks into your family, sees who you are, knows everything, and tries to see, you know, if it's a good match. And
so you went on a matchmaking date.
Yeah, I've been on quite a few matchmaking dates. Probably about, yeah, they were not a match. You know? until I kind of just went behind my mom's back, I guess, and just like went on G-Swipe and did my own thing. And that's where I met like Andrew.
Yeah.
And yeah, but these dates, you know, there's absolutely no kissing, no touching. I might have broken that once and had my first kiss on a date. And yeah, I remember it was on the AMC theater by Union Square, 14th
Classic,
Street.
Classic. So sex is reserved for marriage.
Yeah, sex is reserved for marriage. And the way Jewish marriage works, it's actually reserved for 2 weeks out of the marriage. Yeah, when a woman has her period, she has seven unclean days. And then after that, when that finishes, she has seven clean days. And then after she goes on day 14, which is ovulation, she goes and purifies herself in the mikveh, which is the water. There are specified mikvehs in Crown Heights and around the Jewish community. And then after that, she can go home and have sex with her husband. They can touch, kiss. But during those 2 weeks where she has had her period and the 7 days after, there are a lot of laws surrounding that. So it is, it's very sacred and very much for marriage. It's a concept called Shomer Nigia, which means we don't touch until married, and it's reserved for husband and wife only. Well, a brother and a sister can touch, you know, and the grandfather, that's fine, and the father, you know.
So sex is reserved for 2 weeks out of the month, let's say.
Yeah.
Got it. And then is that so? And then in terms of like the teaching of periods and menstruation and stuff, is that not really discussed,
so,
or is it?
I was absent. So I was absent on that day in sixth grade. So I didn't have it, and I was so disappointed because like the nurse had come and she did this talk and everyone was so excited about the talk. And but you know, they talked about periods and taught you how to use a pad, no tampons. I don't know why they didn't teach tampons, but I guess when you're in sixth grade, it's a little early anyway. And yeah, so she taught about that and just like about like, I guess like also hygiene, like wearing deodorant, that kind of stuff. And then in ninth grade, we had our biology class. We go according to the New York State Regents. And so we studied, you know, we studied sex ed there. Not sex ed. We studied just about sexual reproduction, you know, in a purely like scientific way.
Right, right, right.
My teacher, I'm not going to say her name. In ninth grade, she was an older lady. And she said, she's like, so when the sperm enters the egg, and in my head I was thinking, okay, I know that's scientific, right? Sperm entering the egg, but why can't it be the egg sort of joining the sperm, you know, and sort of like a choice of a woman, right? This is my choice in my body if I want to go to that, you know. But I didn't say anything.
And it was always from more of a scientific, it was never talking about pleasure, never anything.
No, absolutely not. No talk of that whatsoever. So they do have, before a woman gets married, they have kala classes and chatan classes, which is bride and groom classes that you go separately with a teacher who has studied the laws of nida, which is your period and the 7-14 days and everything. And she will teach you about, you know, sex and just kind of the logistics of it. And same for the man. The rabbi will teach him about, you know, some of them don't know, you know, if they've never seen anything.
Totally.
You know, sort of what a penis is, what a vagina is, or what, you know, where does this penis enter into my body, right?
Right, right.
And so they'll teach about that. And I know, you know, many people have been following this woman on Instagram who is a teacher. She's a college teacher. And she focuses a lot on pleasure and orgasm. And that's really great. And I think maybe back in the day that wasn't stressed so much. Nobody really talked about it. But I think today that that is changing, which is great because, you know, there's a huge gap between, you know, male, female, the female pleasure gap, basically.
So, I mean, how did you learn to like, or if you feel that you have, like, how did you learn to prioritize your pleasure and like, if you, or learn this stuff, like, because you're not married, how did, and you chose to date on your own, like, was that, I mean, were you like, what am I don't know what, like, what I'm doing?
No, I, you know, the first time I ever kind of discovered my own body, I was very old. I was like 21 or 22. It was with a friend and I like, yeah, I was like, oh, wow, that feels really good. You know, what is that? And then I sort of discovered myself and went, you know, from there. And I did not have sex until I was, well, penetrative sex, until I was 26, maybe. It was 25 or 26. And, you know, once I discovered my body, like, it was okay. I was always, you know, I'm confident. And
you felt good about it.
Yeah, no shame about it whatsoever. You know, I can't speak for others, but for me, no shame about my sexuality and pleasure, or, you know, asking the person I was with, like, no, I don't like that. I like this. This doesn't feel good. This feels good. And yeah, just very confident. But I could see, like, I remember one time I was with one man and, you know, he had a lot of shame and it really pained me to kind of see. He was from the Orthodox community, had a lot of shame just about sexuality and being together with me. And, you know, I tried to help him, but that, like, really, I was like, wow, like, that comes from sort of the Orthodox world where it's like, you know, you don't, a man is not supposed to masturbate, you know, until, not supposed to masturbate. Sex is for marriage, you know.
And that's the only, you're supposed to only really get pleasure from that penetrative act.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times it is reserved for procreation until you're older, you know, and you can't have kids anymore. But yeah, I, you know, for me, it was a journey, just sort of learning, but definitely no shame, no guilt. You know, it took me time, I think, and this, I don't think was from the religious world. I think many women go through this of just to kind of, you know, stick up for myself in a way, like, no, I don't want to do that right now. Like, that's not going to happen right now. I'm not, you're not coming over to my house. Like, no, you know, don't ask me again. That took time. That was a process. And yeah.
Did it bother you at all? Like, when you were learning or not learning, did it feel like the education surrounding sex and the body that you were getting, or even the limited, well, I mean, did it sound more like man oriented, or was it more just like centered around, like, you kind of said, pure like science and like procreation, and that was kind of it?
Yeah, I mean, it was that, but there really like was none. So there was no talk about sex or anything. I remember in 11th grade, we had actually a class taught by like a Kala teacher, like a bride teacher. And she wasn't, from what I remember, she wasn't really talking about, or definitely like no talk about orgasm or pleasure. She was talking about just like, you know, this pleasure is reserved for marriage. It's very holy. Or she was like giving some advice about like marriage or something. One thing I do remember that I agreed with her, like now looking back, is like, you know, before you get married, if you do have a wedding and you have your period, you're considered unclean. And so a lot of times, you know, they don't want that to happen because on the night of your wedding, you consummate the marriage and have sex. And so a lot of times women will just be, you know, handed a white pill, birth control, you know, by some college teacher who is not a medical professional, and just like give it to them, be like, take this so you don't get your period. And she kind of empowered us to be like, no, like, it's your body. Like, if you don't want that, you don't know what that pill is, like, no, you should be going to a doctor, like, not just taking the pill. And so that's what I remember that kind of stayed with me.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
How did you, like, how did you avoid feeling shame?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't, this is what I said. Maybe part of it is going to an all-girls school and being like, I own the place, you know.
But did you and your friends talk about stuff like that or not really?
In high school, no. Like, I literally, like, didn't, I felt like I didn't even know, like, enough anatomy to even talk about it. Like, I didn't even know what a clitoris was.
Yeah.
You know?
And when you got your period for the first time, like, you didn't share it with anybody?
No, I was embarrassed of it. Like, maybe that's, like, a high school thing. I got my period very late. I was, like, in 10th grade or something. End of 9th grade, but, you know, told my mother, my sisters, like, helped me. Wasn't until years later that I learned how to use tampons. Just because I feel like I wasn't comfortable or knew about my anatomy. That's something that I hope will change, you know, in the current education system. But in terms of not having shame, I think it's just, you know, maybe resiliency, maybe just how I was raised around a bunch of, like, women, powerful women, girls that I saw in my family. And yeah, it just didn't, you know, it wasn't a thing. I remember, you know, until I was 19 years old, I wasn't even aware that that there were, like, fat people, skinny people, or different body types. To me, it was just like, everyone's a body, like, you know, it is what it is. And then I went, a year after high school, I studied abroad in Israel, in what we call seminary. That's like a Jewish studies program. And we had a mirror out in the hallway in the dorm, and girls would look in the mirror and be like, do I look fat in this? And I was like, what? Like, what do you mean? Like, I didn't understand. I'm just like, that's just your body. Like, you know, and then after it kind of occurred to me, like, oh, there's different body types. And I started to become, you know, like, more aware of that. But I kind of contributed maybe just sort of to my upbringing. My mom is very strong. You kind of never talked about that you shouldn't love your body. Or there's something flawed about it, you know? And so maybe from that, I don't, you know, but,
that's helpful in that way, you know?
Yeah. You know, it wasn't perfect. I did not have a perfect childhood.
Totally.
There was certainly a lot of, you know, challenging, painful events that happened, and relationships with my mom, but, you know, you
can,
but yeah, no shame, you know, and I encourage women to, like, there's a pleasure gap, like, be as loud as you want, you know, ask for what you want, speak about it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there's also this concept, like, in society of, like, you know, partnered sex is the only sex, and that's just not true, you know?
And so your focus in your therapeutic work is, are you only seeing couples now?
So I see couples and individuals. Yeah.
And do you see people that are Orthodox or are is that, like, you want it to be your specialty, or you see all types of couples?
No, I see, you know, right now I still have to get my 3000 hours to be practicing independently. So I work under somebody else, and I have yet to see an Orthodox or ex-Orthodox individual in San Francisco. I wish I could. It would be fascinating for me.
Do you think there's a need? Or, I mean, the idea of therapy in the Orthodox community, is that a thing? Or it's
Most definitely.
Rabbi?
No, I think today, you know, maybe like back then, right, 30 years ago, probably not. But today, you know, I've worked in a couple of the Orthodox schools, and it's like every kid has a therapist. It's like, when am I going out to my therapist? You know, so it's very much, you know, just sort of, you know, open about it. And from my experience, doesn't seem to be that there is a stigma. I've been in my own therapy since I'm 19 years old with the same therapist. And then when I moved to California, I had to change. So
I know, sucks.
Yeah.
Was your old therapist Orthodox?
No, she was a Jew, which really helped me because sort of the culture, totally. But she understood it. I believe her husband was from a Orthodox community as well. And so she got it. So Yeah, but I think that there definitely is a need for therapists to work with the Orthodox world. And there actually is Footsteps. I don't know if you've heard about it.
No, tell me more.
Yeah, Footsteps is a great organization that was actually started by a girl from the Chabad community. I believe her name is Malki Schwartz, and she is my friend's sister. And it's just providing like therapy to people who have, they call them OTD, who have off the derech, they've left the community, and kind of, and need support. So they'll offer them help with getting into college, reading classes. Some of them don't know how to read English. If they're coming, like say from South Williamsburg, you know, therapy for them, groups, so they can have community. Oftentimes when people leave the Orthodox community, they don't have community because it's such a community-based organization. Mm. And if people have, you know, that they don't fit in anymore, or, you know, if they don't have a big family, then it's really hard to not have that sense of community. And so Footsteps provides that for them.
Mm. And, yeah. And wow. And that's based in New York, Brooklyn?
Yeah, it's based in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Wow.
Or maybe it's in the city.
Yeah. And it helps. Particularly, it sounds like women or anybody from
anybody, men and women. There's also in the, to my knowledge, this doesn't happen so much in Crown Heights Chabad Hasidic community, but in Williamsburg and maybe Bar Park, you know, in other Orthodox world, they, you know, if a woman leaves her community and decides to become not religious, oftentimes her children could be alienated from her. And you know, she could lose rights to having her children. And these people have a lot of money and a lot of power within the government and the courts, and so they can easily do that. And so Footsteps helps a lot with that, to make sure that mothers are not separated from their children. Or same thing for fathers. Some fathers are like, you know, the moms are like, you're not religious, you're never seeing your kid again. Wow. And that's just horrible.
Yeah.
And so Footsteps helps a lot with that.
Wow. Yeah. That's really interesting. Do you have any interest in working with, you know, the Orthodox community?
Yeah, definitely. My primary interest of really why I went to school to become a therapist was I saw that there was a big gap for children and people with autism that are higher functioning, but don't, you know, or people that are not neurotypical, that kind of don't fit into, you know, a special ed school, but don't fit into the regular school. And so that place in between. So I kind of wanted to create, you know, be a therapist for that.
Do you still want to do that?
Yeah, definitely. My heart is very much, you know, with children.
Yeah.
And, you know, protecting children and the rights of children. And so, but definitely, you know, I hope to one day open up a private practice for families and children. And maybe couples sort of do a little bit of everything. And yeah, definitely would want to work with Orthodox people, you know, because I think it's a lot of times between the client and therapist, it's like the relationship. I'm a big believer in the relationship. Irving Yalom is my hero.
yeah. And,
yeah. So, you know, that's sort of like, if I can understand them, you know, better, and I understand it because I come from that world, then more healing could be done.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think it's very unique. You know, when you're in the Orthodox world, like, and you're in that community, they take care of you. If your house is in foreclosure, they're going to come and pay it off. If you need money and you have cancer, there's an organization. If you need food for the holidays, there's an organization. They're going to take care of you. But I think when you leave, that's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Do a lot of people go back if they've stepped away and then they come back, or is that not as common?
I don't know, maybe for some. I mean, yeah. Do you know the ex-Hasidic rapper Modest Young?
No.
Yeah, so he, you know, he's like real, I really like his music. It's a lot of reggae.
Wait,
and
what?
Yeah.
Okay, wait, what's his name?
His name is Matis Yahu.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me.
So he did not grow up religious, and then he became religious, and then he went off, you know, stopped being religious. So it's kind of like not religious. Yeah, that's him.
Wow. Yeah. I have heard of him. Yeah. I just didn't know he was
Hasidic.
I don't know if this is true, but I think Mark and Andrew might have gone to his concert on the Brooklyn Bowl or something.
Okay. Checks out, probably.
Yeah.
So, okay, sorry. So you were saying that.
So he kind of like, I guess this doesn't really answer your question, but you know, he wasn't religious, then he became religious, and then now he's not religious. So I guess people like, you know, kind of the path. But in terms of people coming back, you know, I don't know anybody that went off and then came back, but I'm sure people do.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of a journey and kind of like what you're, you know, feeling in your life at certain times. I think it's, you know, people are, you know, very changeable.
Do you think there are considerations that therapists shouldn't be aware of in either working with Orthodox couples or Orthodox individuals? Like I took a class on Islam and sexuality, and the educator was talking about considerations that people shouldn't, you know, basically what we've been talking about here, like misconceptions that people have about various religions and what we've been taught, you know, and how the misconceptions that people have and can have. And it was really useful because, you know, she kind of did a background of the ideology of Islam. And then she kind of did, you know, considerations like in terms of what may come up for couples and like sex therapy, or what may come up for couples and or like women or men or gender nonconforming, you know. So it was just interesting in how she framed it. But
yeah, definitely. Well, first of all, you know, I say with anything, when we have a client who's a different culture from us, it's not their job to educate us.
Totally.
You know, that's our job to go and, you know, find out what we want to know. And always approach it with, you know, open mind and open heart. And, you know, if they do decide to stay in the religious community, like to you, it might seem, let's say, you know, you have a guy, you know, a Hasidic guy who comes into your office, and he in the summer is wearing, you know, a long black coat and his hat and his jacket and the, you know, long black pants and white shirt and the fringes, the tzitzit. You know, those feelings that you have of it's so hot outside, what the fuck is he wearing, outside the room, because that will, your client will feel that.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that that's powerful to come from, you know, client is the expert, sort of a not knowing stance, you know, I don't know, you know, what is it? And to really understand, like, you know, and then on the flip side of somebody who is, you know, has left the community, to really understand that they've really left their community and they may not have anybody. And, you know, the Orthodox community provides a huge sense of family, and there's always something going on, and, you know, there's the culture, and that can be really hard. And I imagine clients could fall into a deep depression and feel really alone when you don't have anybody. And then in terms of, let's say, you know, suggesting that they go see a psychiatrist for medication, right? You know, for them, that might, there's sort of a stigma associated with medication, because, you know, medication, then they go to, you know, the marriage, the matchmaker, you know, maybe they would have to keep that a secret, or maybe, you know, they don't want to tell, because then, you know, I remember for myself, when I was doing that, I, you know, gone through some hard times and decided that, you know, I was going to see a psychiatrist on my own and get an SSRI. And I remember just feeling really bad, like I'm lying about it. Like, what is this guy going to think, you know, whatever. And, you know, there's a stigma associated with it and something that you can't share. So to be mindful of that, to be mindful about, you know, if you are a woman seeing a male client, they may not shake your hand on the first session, because they don't do that. That is forbidden by Jewish law to, you know, touch the opposite sex who's not your, you know, immediate family, or your husband. And then like sex, you know, I find in my work as a couples therapist, sex is like the number one thing that comes up. It's always there.
Tell me more. Like, it just in your couples work in general.
In my couples work, it's just, you know, I find that so much, you know, if the relationship is not in a good place, then the sex is not in a good place. Mm. And couple, you know, or they just don't talk about it, or there's a gap. There's a lot of times there's a pleasure gap.
Mm.
You know, women are not you know, not orgasming, and they, you know, don't feel pleased, and their husbands, you know, just don't know how to do it, or they don't know how to communicate about it, you know. Or I was seeing a couple recently, and they, like, one couple, you know, I mean, this is sort of going off on a tangent because of sexual trauma, like, you know, won't take off her clothes, or a lesbian couple won't, you know, get naked and let her partner see her. Let's talk about that, you know?
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's a big deal. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of with the Orthodox community, going back to that, you know, let's say, right, with couples, let's say if I had an Orthodox couple and I didn't know anything and I suggested to them, like, you know, why don't you schedule, you know, having sex once a week? That would be totally ridiculous. You can't have sex more than 2 weeks out of the marriage, you know, out of the month. But like, that's like, you know, I have to learn and ask, like, you know, like, what is this? What are, you know, sort of the laws surrounding it? Or let me Google it.
That's true.
Or even if I suggested, well, are there other ways? What about, can you maybe kiss your partner? Nope, there's no kissing during that time either. It's complete, you know.
During the two weeks, there's no kissing.
No kissing, no touching, no passing.
No passing?
Yeah, like if you, you know, there's a can on the table, you know, and you pass it, you're not supposed to pass it because it's like touching, I guess.
Mm.
Or could lead to touching. And I do want to say, like, it's interesting because a lot of the world, you know, perhaps like looks upon that, like it's that 2 weeks as like, you know, this is like horrible. Like, what do you mean? And for me, it doesn't work because I don't want to be told, you know, by a religious authority when I can and can't be with my partner. I would like to just leave that up to myself. So it doesn't work for me, but for other people, you know, there is, I do feel, and especially as a couples therapist, that the American marriage is, you know, 50% of couples sleep in separate bedrooms.
Mm.
And I guess with that number, 50% of couples, you know, are not having enough sex or are not having as much sex as they want. Mm. And I think with this like 2 weeks kind of thing, it's sort of the concept of absence makes the heart grow fonder. And sort
is
of
that it its intention?
That is sort of its intention. Yeah. I believe that one of the more, you know, esoteric reasons, yes. Mm. Is sort of to make it more exciting and just, you know, sets boundaries around the marriage and the relationship of like, you know, even though a man may want to do that, he cannot, he's forbidden. Even though, like, I believe, well, if the woman says no, like, it's no, it doesn't, you know, we don't need someone else to tell us that. So, you know, that's sort of, but, you know, I don't disagree with it. Maybe, you know, for them, it works. And like, if they're happy, you know, then so be it.
Do you have any idea of like, is it just a thing that people, that they say, but like, no one really follows it? Or like, mostly people follow it?
So from my understanding, like what I've talked to my like more religious friends, they'll say that no, they like, some people will be like, okay, I won't have sex on my period. And so they won't do that. And then there's other people who are like, well, it's just, we just won't have sex during those 2 weeks. And then I'll go to the mikvah, you know, the waters, the purified waters after. But during those 2 weeks, we'll touch, we'll kiss, we'll sleep in the same bed. Orthodox couples also sleep in separate beds. Because of that 2 week thing. When the 2 weeks is fine, then yes, you can sleep together.
Got it.
But I think it's like a mix. Like my parents, I observe them keeping it to a T. And I kind of always wondered, I'm like, why the heck are they like not touching? Like, it's like, you know, why are they not passing something that seems so bizarre? And then I learned about it when I was older. We like had this book in our house and I was like, let me go read that, you know.
Oh, so you didn't know why that was happening?
No, I was just like, and I think I even asked my mom one day, and she's like, I don't remember what she said, but she's like, you'll learn when you're older.
The classic.
Yeah, but like I found like the book in our house, and when my mom was out one Shabbat, like went and read it, and I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Do you find that you like physical touch now? Like, are you do you show affection that way?
Yes and no. Physical touch, I wouldn't say is like my love language, but I definitely enjoy it.
Mm.
And you know, I see like physical touch and sex are two different things.
Totally.
To me in a way.
Yeah.
Am I like the biggest hugger? No, I've never been. and, you know, but in a relationship, if something is important to your partner, you know, you make an effort on it. I have to practice what I preach, right? Sometimes, you know, now I'm working from home and sometimes it's like, you know, I could have a session and I'm telling this couple everything and then I come out and have a huge fight with Andrew. Why would you put the dishes like that in the dishwasher? It's like, here goes my whole like work, you know?
I guess in the couples that you, in your couple's work so far, what are common themes that come up? Like, is it, like you said, differences in sex or like sexual desire seems like a thing.
Yeah, definitely. You know, differences and discrepancies. I think that, you know, it's always harder for the partner, you know, when you're in a healthy relationship, not an abusive one, and the partner that says, no, you know, I don't want to have sex right now, or constantly rejects the other partner, then it's most painful for the person who's being rejected. And so there's a lot of that because it's like, why don't you like me? Like, why don't, you know, like, what's wrong with me? Are you just not attracted to me? What is it? And so there's kind of that. And a lot of times that's a work with moms and a lot of them are just touched out and they're tired and exhausted. And it's been a pandemic and they're just like, I don't want you to touch me.
Yeah.
I don't want to have sex. Like, I'm tired.
The touched out thing is real.
Yeah. So see a lot of that, but I would say really the crux of it in couples therapy is that one partner is anxious attachment and one is avoidant attachment. That is the crux of it. It's, you know, the other partner, the one who's, let's say, you know, anxiously attached and is like, you know, come here, why didn't you like hug me and kiss me when you got home? And then the other one's like, I need my space, you know, like get away. And so there's sort of that dynamic and the opposites attract. And so, you know, it's kind of talking about that, which comes into, I think, every aspect of the relationship. But, you know, I've seen like, yeah, just a lot of growth with couples, you know, in my work. And it's been very empowering for me to see that, like, oh, wow, I can actually do this, you know, because sometimes it's just pretending that you know something and then like, you know.
Please, I know. Or it's like Googling it immediately before the session.
Definitely communication. You know, a lot of times like, yeah, what couples therapy could provide for couples is like just a place where they could talk. A lot of times they don't talk to each other. You know, or they're conflict avoidant and just can't get into the conversation. Yeah, and then just, you know, some that have to do, you know, deep repair work that comes up. There's a lot of stuff dealing with in-laws. That's a big one. You know, kids.
I imagine that's a good one. I imagine the in-laws comes up, or just the merging of family, or, you know, the merging of families, developing what your family wants to look like while navigating each other's, yeah. You know, it's like more people. It's just more.
Yeah, definitely. I, you know, have like one of my good friends that I grew up with, she always like tells me, like whenever I see her a few times a year, she'll tell me like, you know, it's easier to get divorced than to stay married. And I really agree with that. Like marriage takes work. Relationships take work. Like I think that we have this like idea that it's just easy or there's not going to be conflict.
Totally.
But there is, and it kind of makes you stronger and you have to like work through it. And, you know, it's like, you know, even right. If people watch porn, then they may have this ideal of sex that it's easy, or that it just happens, or that a woman just comes and then it just like that, you know? But you know, sometimes and, you know, the man could be into Antarctica and she's in Florida, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
You know, yeah. So it's just, you know, it takes work and it takes discussion. And I think that, you know, that's hard for people.
Yeah.
Relationships are hard.
My last question would be like, how do you practice Judaism now? And like, how does it help your relationships in general, I guess, like both with friends, partners, anybody, you know, like your, like, how does it impact your life?
Yeah. So how I practice it now is, let's say, like, you know, we'll host Shabbat meals a couple times a month or twice a month. Yeah. Mm. We will, let's say, like, in terms of like kosher meat. So this is like purely like, I'm vegetarian, but I was like cooking like dinner and chicken for Andrew. And the non-kosher chicken here was just disgusting to me. It had fat all over it and all the schmutz. And I was like, that's it. And so we ordered kosher from a place in Vegas. And we just get all our meat like shipped, you know, express overnight. And so that's kosher. So I guess we'll keep that. I light Shabbat candles every Friday night. It's a woman's mitzvah commandment to light Shabbat candles. And that's something that I've been doing since I'm 3 years old. Mm. So I do that. And, you know, on occasion, there's still stuff that still like stay with me. Like it's a requirement, a commandment to, when you wake up in the morning, to wash nitilat yadayim, or in Yiddish, negel vasser, which is to wash your hands, you know, three on one side or one on just like this, you know, wash your hands with water. And that kind of purifies you for the day, because when you're sleeping, it's said that your soul kind of leaves you. And then when you wake up, it returns to you. And so there's sort of, you need the purification. And I guess the last thing is your fingertips. Mm. And so that kind of stays with me. And that's like a ritual that I do, you know, every day. When I go to bed at night, I say the Jewish prayer of the Shema, which is just kind of, you know, talking about the love of God. And, you know, holidays, I keep the holidays, not in the same way that I was raised. You know, I have a mezuzah on my doorpost, which is, you know, it has the Shema inside the scroll. That to me is important. You know, I want people to pass by and be like, oh, this is a Jewish home. And I believe, you know, it provides protection, you know, to our family. And yeah, but in terms of like keeping, you know, the specifics, no, I don't really keep that. And what was the second part of your question?
How do you feel like it impacts your relationships the way you practice now, if it does at all?
No, I mean, it used to be like, I wouldn't. So here it's kind of like, this is one way that kind of bothers me. It was challenging. Like I like to keep my phone off on Saturday. Mm. Now we live in a building that's impossible to get into unless my phone's on.
Wait, why? Because you like need a code or whatever?
The code downstairs doesn't work. And so it's like a whole thing. And so I have to like keep my phone on because the person has to call me and then I have to go down. We've been trying to get them to fix it, but we'll see. And Andrew's not always home. Sometimes he's on call. And so I can't rely on the person and tell them to just call him. Mm. And so that's like been a little challenge. At the same time, I'm like, Shabbat for me is about having friends over and just kind of relaxing and being with them. And so that's sort of like, it sounds so like minuscule, but like in talking about like how we could help our clients, right? That would be something that might, you know, really stay with a client and be kind of difficult for them, you know? Mm-hmm. And like these little things, like it's so small, you know, that you wouldn't even think about, you know? So something like that. But in terms of my relationship with Andrew, no, you know, we sort of do our own thing. You know, I've also taken to sort of compromising, you know, for the relationship. If, you know, Andrew has very limited schedule and vacations, and, you know, if he wants to drive somewhere one Saturday, I'm open to that. Like, I'm comfortable with that. I've made that decision. Mm. You know, I think that, like, it, you know, it works for the relationship.
Shayna Adelstein, one of nine siblings, was born and raised in the Chabad Hasidic Orthodox Jewish world of Brooklyn, New York. Shayna is a licensed social worker in New York State and California. Today, Shayna is a practicing San Francisco and Oakland therapist who works with couples, adults, teenagers, and children. In her work, Shayna is most passionate about educating and empowering teenagers and children about all things related to body safety and healthy sexuality. In her spare time, Shayna can be found singing to Hasidic music, swimming, dreaming of her nieces and nephews, or playing with her puppy. Shayna currently resides in San Francisco with her partner. As always, thanks for listening. You can find me on Instagram at PsychAndTheCityBK. You can find me on Twitter, PsychNDTheCity. And you can find me at email at psychinthecitybk@gmail.com. Please email me if you'd like me to have someone on the podcast, you want to come on the podcast, or you want to hear me talk about a topic. Thanks. Bye.